case, United States v. Washington, number 21-2740.
Recording in progress.
And you may, would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
If I could, 3 minutes.
That would be granted.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Christy Martin. I represent the appellant, Yasheem Washington. Your Honor, it's vast that we address two issues involving the constitutional rights of a defendant at trial. I'll begin with the issue of waiver of counsel. Both issues have a substantial body of precedent to guide district courts in these situations, to guide this court in its review. To begin, we have a presumption, a default presumption, that counsel will be provided to a defendant, and that can only be waived with a knowing and intelligent waiver, as you're aware.
Yes. Is McFadden still good law in this area? And I'm specifically interested in your views as to whether we can take account of the first trial and matters that may have occurred during the trial as well.
Your Honor, McFadden has not been explicitly overruled. McFadden took place in 1980, just a couple years later in United States versus Welty, and consistently thereafter. The case has been held to its facts, is the best that I could say as far as being overruled. We have a lot of precedent since then, which really emphasizes that a rote speech or a perfunctory speech without reflection is not sufficient. I think that McFadden at the time was being looked at under a different standard, and the court did at that time indicate that it felt that his waiver was knowing and voluntary and intelligent, which is what the basic standard is. I guess, so that's a long way of answering your question, but since that time, we've had case after case after case. We have Welty in 1982, all the way up through Taylor last year. This court has consistently said that we do not look to the entire record to find that knowing and intelligent waiver. And this is for good reason. We don't want district courts to have to be looking at fuzzy pieces of the record and different proceedings and drawing lines about how long ago, what type of proceeding.
But in this case, the time difference was about 2 months. The proceeding that was conducted at trial number one was a Peppers-type, Feretta-type proceeding. It was repeated almost verbatim in trial number two. The only difference really was the defendant's responses, and the responses differed only in this way: a repeated focus on his claimed lack of access to discovery or lack of review of discovery with their adversary. So doesn't this make it more like a situation where we should look to consider what's happened now, exactly the same type of proceeding that only happened about 60 days earlier?
Your Honor, I could understand the instinct to want to do that. The problem is, and we have precedent, in 2006, the court said we look at the time a defendant seeks to waive counsel. We know that circumstances change, issues change, frankly, competency and states of mind change, and I don't think there's any way to craft an easily administrable rule about what we can and cannot look at. I'll add, in this situation, the first colloquy was not really any more successful.
What was different was Mr. Washington said he wanted an attorney, just didn't want the attorney with him. In colloquy number two, he repeatedly said, "I want to proceed pro se." You're correct. Their responses were different, and the outcomes were different, obviously.
Yes, obviously.
Rule a little formalistic? It is temporally very close. What's the cutoff? I mean, do we have to, every day at trial, do the same thing to make sure this day he didn't change his mind?
We don't, Your Honor. And I think when we're looking at the same proceeding, And I'm not in a position to draw this line. There's not the facts here. But, for example, as in the Santos case, which was not published, at arraignment, there was a knowing and intelligent waiver. The court was still proceeding with the same case. And the court actually took it, the district court took it upon itself to do another colloquy, and it was clear that that was not necessary. I think if we had pretrial motions and the case was merely proceeding without any sort of hurdles or indications that there was a problem, you may be able to in the same proceeding. But to try to sort of pick and choose what will and will not be sufficient, I think is less workable here, especially in a difficult situation that Mr. Washington presented. The court needed to be very clear. And if I may, the court had a very clear decision in front of it. In Taylor, this court adopted what was argued by the government in that case, that where a defendant creates a verbal impasse or stymies the court's inquiry, that's a waiver of the right to self-representation. The district court, unfortunately, here did not recognize that, but I think there is a very bright line to be drawn here, that if a defendant will not participate, there's no way that the court can find a knowing waiver.
You're talking about Taylor. it seems that we explain that district courts need not conduct an actual colloquy. A monologue might work. Why does that not apply here?
Well, Your Honor, the issue of monologue, and there is... I know the government relies on a Sixth Circuit case, and that circuit does have, I'm sorry, 11th Circuit, they do have a different standard there. They accept that a monologue in certain circumstances may be sufficient. And keeping in mind that they still have that knowing and intelligent finding that has to be made. This court has never accepted that. This court in Virgin Allen versus Charles and everything since, and in Taylor said a rote speech or a perfunctory questioning is not going to be sufficient. Because what we have to look at is really what the defendant knows.
Well, let's do that. Why don't we do that? And we'll focus only on trial number two for the purposes of this inquiry. The district court addressed the defendant, asked each of the required questions. You agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. The defendant sometimes responded in a way that would reflect an answer to the court's question, but even during the course of the colloquy, the court asked, are you going to answer my questions? He said no. So is a judge supposed to then override a multiple proclamation, I want to proceed pro se, when you have a defendant who's been recalcitrant that way? Aren't we going to see the opposite on appeal if we have a defendant who then says, I'm going to force out you to have counsel? Then what is a court of appeals going to do when that record reflects repeated requests to proceed pro se? When the kinds of things he didn't respond to, and I'm sorry this is going on a little long, were more like warnings. Let me tell you about the risks. Let me tell you about the risks. You don't know the rules. Mm-hmm. I can't advise you. There are defenses a lawyer might think of. It's a warning that's being given. And shouldn't we find that to be sufficient if we have a defendant who's demonstrating engagement with the court, just wanting to talk about something different, which is what I think occurred here?
I think, exactly what occurred here. At all times, he appeared to be having a wholly different conversation. Because we're looking at what he knows and understands, those were the important questions. And I think we cannot, just like with the clear and unequivocal request, if there's any hesitation or retreat from that, the court cannot find that request, and we have to be consistent here. Very similar to like a Rule 11 guilty plea, for example. If there is one question that we cannot get the defendant past, then that plea cannot go forward.
So you want us to adopt a test that if any one of the Pepper's questions or Ferretta questions is not responded to with either a yes or a no or something that appears like they're engaged in the same subject, no pro se status.
That's I would agree test. With that.
That's the test you want to blanket.
I do love a bright line test. I will say, Your Honor,
it's got to be a responsive question to each and every question. is what you're saying.
Or some acknowledgement that the defendant is participating. Absolutely, I don't think that is too much.
So are you saying that this record suggests that Mr. Washington was not participating in the conversation with the court?
He was not. When he spoke, he was having an entirely different conversation, unfortunately. To answer your other question, we did have the opposite situation in Taylor. In Taylor, the district court had very valid, no doubt, concerns about the defendant's sovereign citizen arguments, and terminated, effectively, the Pepper's colloquy because of those concerns. And Mr. Taylor went forward with counsel, and what this court said was that he had not stymied the colloquy, he had not put an end to it, he was participating, the district court needed to continue with the colloquy. So it was sort of the opposite situation that you have here.
Could I ask about shackling?
Sure.
Shackling subject?
Of course.
What kind of proceeding do you think the district court should have held under these facts? Now, there's no doubt that a court can consider the entire record in making a decision about shackling. So what kind of proceeding do you think this district court judge should have had before making the shackling decision?
Well, Your Honor, the proceeding does not have to be long. I think the important thing here is that the defense, and Mr. Washington was represented at that moment when the defense objected, is the defense needs to be given an opportunity to understand the basis for the shackling and to make any arguments against it.
But here we have, because we can consider the first trial, we have a record of the tussle in connection with the fingerprinting. We have a report of a threatening comment made to his then-retained counsel during trial number one. So people are on notice of what had occurred. What more should the district court have done?
Well, I think, it was 2 months later. And understandably, the district court had seen a lot of cases since that time. So we don't know exactly what the district court was thinking, in particular because it was an ex parte discussion. What the court did tell us was that he was simply going to take the advice of the marshals, and that is not okay.
But didn't he also say, and if circumstances change, I may revisit that?
He did.
Reflect he was maybe cognizant of a recommendation, but it was his decision and his alone as to whether to continue?
It was incumbent upon him to make that clear on the record what that basis was and why he was accepting that recommendation. I understand the government, obviously we have slightly divergent perspectives on how serious the record was. I certainly do not question that he had to be forced to be fingerprinted some 2 months earlier, and that there was, as we know from the first colloquy, some serious problems with his relationship with first counsel. Those were not at issue at this point, and I think we don't know. We cannot, I do want to address the second incident, which involved him being carried to the witness stand. I can't emphasize enough that when we read the trial transcript, it's very clear that the actual shackling was a root cause of that incident, and we cannot use that to justify, in retrospect, the court's decision. Mr. Washington vocalized, I apologize, I see that I'm out of time, he vocalized a lot of frustration in his efforts to represent himself, but at no other point was there any indication that frustration or exasperation was turning into a physical dynamic until that moment.
Judge Sirica has a question.
Going back to the first question that we asked you, Taylor recommended that standby counsel be appointed in these kinds of situations, and in fact, there was standby counsel in this case. To what extent did that should we take that into account in deciding whether the waiver was proper?
Your Honor, I believe in the older cases, you see the court mentioning the presence of standby counsel, as it was not, I think, it was not a standard practice early on to have standby counsel. At this point, I'm not aware of any cases where standby counsel is not appointed. I believe that is a default position, if you will. And I don't think it had I don't think that it aided Mr. Washington in any way here, because he, quite frankly, just had not intelligently waived his right to counsel.
And did standby counsel participate in the trial?
I would say there were a couple of objections when the jury was not present that Ms. Jayaraman asked to put on the record. And also, I believe she notified the court a couple of times when he wanted to request something. But there wasn't, this was not a situation where standby counsel opened and closed or participated in the defendant's testimony.
Can I ask a last question? It's a factual one that I wasn't quite sure about in terms of your position. Back to the fingerprinting incident, do you agree that your client was tased?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I was not there, and the counsel who was involved was private counsel prior to our appointment. Right. I do understand that that was the case, and okay. We don't question that.
All right. Thank you. We'll get you on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Zosmer?
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Robert Zosmer on behalf of the government. With respect to the pro se issue, I think there's a lot to say, but the important point is that the colloquy is a specific colloquy is not required. It's never been required by the Supreme Court. I think this court did a very useful service to the district courts in the Peppers case in prescribing a suggested colloquy. As someone who deals with these issues pretty regularly in the district court, I can say that really was an excellent service, and it's been very helpful to district courts to have a procedure that they can follow. But it's never been, and this court has repeatedly said, this is not required. This is a suggestion. And the reason it's not required is we go back to the Supreme Court precedent on what this is all about. What this is all about is simply assuring that the defendant is knowingly and intelligently waiving his very important right to counsel. And what this court said in the Peppers case is what it comes down to, with not the specific questions, what it comes down to is, has he clearly and unequivocally expressed his desire to represent himself? Does he understand the nature of the charges, the range of possible punishments, the potential defenses, technical problems he may encounter? And is he competent to stand trial? That's what this is about. And when you look at this record, there's no question that Judge Bartle had a basis for finding those requirements met. Judge Bartle made a specific finding that Mr. Washington was knowingly and intelligently waiving his right to counsel.
What was the factual basis for that in light of the answers that Mr. Washington was given?
The factual basis was the full record. Now, let me address that point.
You mean full record, like outside trial number two?
Yes. Actually, trial number two was sufficient. But I do want to address this whole record question because it's important. And Judge Sirica's question is very important about, you know, whether McFadden is still good law. McFadden, of course, is good law. It's never been overturned by the court. And this court said to McFadden that you do look to the whole record to see what the defendant knew. That's consistent with Supreme Court precedent in a number of areas. The one that comes to mind immediately when I was listening to my friend Ms. Martin was the guilty plea context. I think someone mentioned Rule 11. And, of course, the Supreme Court has held that in looking at the voluntariness of a plea, you look at the entire record. That's sort of basic. But what's striking about this case is that when you look at the whole record in this case, you're not just pulling tidbits from different moments in the proceedings to say, did he know the punishment? Did he know the charge? You know, McFadden, they look back at the record to say, yes, he knew what the maximum punishment was. In this case, when you look at the full record, what you're looking at is the exact same colloquy in the exact same circumstance on the exact same issue that took place 60 days before. We really don't have a precedent like that this court has addressed in a precedential opinion, but it has to be that, of course, we can look at that in answering these basic questions. Does he know the nature of the charges? Does he know what he's facing?
But counsel, your adversary, your friend says, well, he could have changed his mind. It was a different trial. He may have changed his mind in the interim.
Well, sure.
And so is it really probative?
And this is why we have incredibly experienced, knowledgeable judges like Judge Bartle, who assesses what's before him. Judge Bartle could certainly look at it and say, you know, well, this is a different, I think he has changed his mind. But that's not the conclusion he reached. He knew he had gone over the same material just 60 days earlier. That's not very long. Some trials last for 60 days. I mean, you know, and we look at the whole proceeding. He knew he had gone over with him. And, you know, if you read this record, it's pretty clear why Judge Bardo made this conclusion. This person was just being manipulative. I mean, he was being obstructionist and difficult at every stage. I think Judge Bardo, rather than criticism, perhaps deserves some kind of award for working through the proceedings. And I'll say the same. I should have introduced my colleague, Ms. Kibitz, who tried the case, who is sitting here and has been,
you know,
been essential in preparing this appeal as well. I'm not saying she's going to get an award, but I will say that about Judge Bardo. When you look at this, I mean, there was one moment in the colloquy where Judge Bardo says, this was on page 471, he says, I advise you, in my opinion, that a trained lawyer will defend you better. I think it's unwise. You're not familiar with court procedure. You're not familiar with the rules of evidence. And Mr. Washington responds, well, I never answered to the question. I mean, he's just manipulating the record here. And that's what allows part of what allows Judge Bardo to make this final conclusion.
But should we look at it in the opposite direction? Chief Judge Chigaris just authored an opinion in United States versus Noble where we had a fully non-responsive defendant, just wouldn't participate in the process. And the cases that were relied upon in that decision included the obstructive defendant. And the kind of the teaching from that those cases are, if you're not going to participate in the process, you don't have the privilege of proceeding pro se. How do we reconcile the obstructive defendant who loses that privilege with someone like an individual you've described as, I think you used the word, manipulative?
Well, I mean, Your Honor, I think, is touching on the real fundamental problem here, which is that we have two sides of a coin. We have the right to represent yourself and the right to be represented by counsel. And I think someone suggested earlier in this hearing that it's a trap because the moment, if he is forced to proceed with counsel here, we know exactly what appeal we would be responding to, you know, once he's convicted at trial. And so the judge has to be very careful here and decide what is the situation. If that's the situation in the judge's determination that this person is being obstructionist and is waiving his right to represent himself, that may be appropriate based on the particular record. This record, though, is very clear in the other direction. This record at the second trial, he repeatedly says at the beginning and at the end, I want to represent myself. And then he's told everything he needs to be told, what he's already been told before and acknowledged before. And at the end, he says the same thing. This only starts, and it's page 462, it only starts when he says, I'm going to proceed pro se. That's what kicks this off. That's an unequivocal statement. And then the judge does all the right things. I want to say one thing about this idea of a rote monologue, which is not what happened here. There's a lot of give and take here. But even a monologue will be sufficient if the judge determines that the defendant knows his rights, knows what he's accused of, knows what the possible punishments are. Because when you think about it, the statements that are being made here are not designed to give the person a legal education. When you're saying to him, you don't understand the rules of evidence, you don't understand the rules of criminal procedures, sentencing guidelines, the goal of this proceeding is not to come out of it where the person has received the education that took the rest of us, you know, years to achieve. It's to point out to him, you don't know these things. And that is accomplished by the monologue part of this colloquy.
So as long as a warning is given, and at least the record suggests the defendant heard those warnings, and we can infer understood them from other responses to other matters, that's sufficient?
Yes. If the basic requirements are met that this court has set out and the Supreme Court has set out, that he knows the charges, he knows the punishments. That was the problem in the Booker case, which I unsuccessfully argued 10 years ago. The Booker case was one in which we said, well, look at the whole record. He obviously knows what he's facing. But the problem there was the judge made mistakes during the colloquy itself. And so the government. It wasn't only the judge's fault. But the judge misstated the maximum punishment. And so the defendant went into this not knowing that he was looking at 20 years more than he was actually looking at. And so this court held, you can't look at the rest of the record. He's misadvised right in this colloquy. Nothing like that happened here. Here you had two fully accurate colloquies that take place 60 days apart that fully inform him, and then a clear record on which Judge Bardo can determine that he is knowingly and intelligently waiving his right to counsel, which is what happened.
Your friend across the aisle pointed out the utility of a bright line rule. Does a Pepper's colloquy ever expire? Should it? And if so, when?
Well, maybe, but I think that would be a factual question for the district judge, and I think this court should defer to whatever the determination is. It can't be that the bright line rule suggested by my friend is correct. It can't be that you have to answer every single question of a colloquy that this court itself has said is not a required colloquy, is just a suggestion. It cannot be that you then go through that proceeding, you have one question wrong, and what's going to happen is we're going to be sending it back over and over for trial courts to retry cases. There's no precedent for that. There's no logic to that. What it's all about is this knowing and intelligent, knowing what he's facing, and it was. I'll touch on the shackling issue if the court wishes.
Yeah.
Is harmless error your best argument in this case?
With respect to shackling, Your Honor, I don't think so. I think that, I mean, it is a very strong argument. But I think the judge made the finding. The judge did not take direction from the marshals. The statement of the court on page 457 is that it's my understanding the marshals have requested the defendant be in shackling. I will therefore take the advice of the marshals. That's perfectly appropriate, but that is the judge's decision.
Should he have done more than just that? Should he have given other reasons or...
I don't know that he needs to give other reasons. I think if there had been an objection, that certainly there then would have been a fuller record, and we've basically gone over what that record would be, that he misbehaved during the first trial. He was in shackles during the first trial without objection because he had to be tased when he needed to be fingerprinted, because he had threatened his lawyer. And so certainly the judge could have made more findings right away, but he wasn't asked to. And then later on, it's very interesting when you have that later incident, which is just a melee in the courtroom, where he has to be dragged to the stand and 10 marshals flood the room. When that happens, later on, Mr. Washington does make an objection. He says to the court, I shouldn't be in shackles. And the judge's response is, after what you just did? Yes, if you asked him for a fuller record, I think there could be. I will say on that point, though, that if this court has any concern about the extent of the findings, the remedy should not be a new trial. It should not be a windfall like that. The answer is simply to send it back to Judge Bartle and ask him to make findings of all the things that happened and what drove his decision. I think we all know what those findings would look like and what that decision would look like, and I don't think it's necessary on this record. We do also, as Your Honor suggests, have a very strong argument with respect to harmless error. The jury would never have known that Mr. Washington was in shackles had he not decided to tell them himself. And other than that, this was an ordinary proceeding. The important rule
and
there...
And there's a curative instruction immediately, right?
Oh, absolutely. And there, just like on the... On the representation side, where we have that clear list from Peppers of what's really required, we have a clear statement from this court in Sides v. Cherry of what we look at. What we look at is the strength of the case in favor of the prevailing party, the effect the restraints might have had in light of the nature of the issues and the evidence involved in the trial, whether measures were taken to prevent the jury from viewing the restraints, and whether the district court instructed the jury. On all of those points, that any error here would be harmless. The government had an exceptionally strong case. It was a short trial. It was essentially unrebutted. Mr. Washington kept saying he had witnesses that never materialized. He had an entire story of what happened that basically was plainly false, that he had friends there and he was at a club and that they put him in the car and that's where he was found, when in fact the club was closed. There was nobody there at the time except for him. And that, of course, is why no defense witnesses materialized. So it's a very strong case. The jury, again, would never have known that he was in shackles. His mention of it was brief. This court has stated that even a brief view of a defendant in shackles is not necessarily prejudicial. And, of course, the court gave an immediate curative instruction. The only suggestion that the defense makes in rebuttal to this in their reply brief is, well, we can't know what impact being in shackles had on him as he maintained his defense. But there's just nothing in the record to show that he was inhibited in any way in presenting, in fact, the same defense that he presented at the first trial.
In fact, the questions were quite similar to the first trial, right?
Exactly, completely. And in fact, he actually read parts of the record from the first trial himself.
He tried to, right?
Right. Well, he actually did. I mean, for his opening statement, for example, Your Honor, was the opening statement that was given by defense counsel at the first trial that he read himself at the second trial. So what the defense is basically suggesting here is that there has to be some kind of per se rule that any time someone is in shackles, we can't know what effect it had on them, and therefore we have to do the thing over again. And that's not the
Can I go back to you talked to us about sides and the four items to be considered. One of the other things it talks about in that case is that there should be a balancing of the security against the prejudice. We don't see any balancing actually happening on the record in the district court. And there was, at the second trial, by his then, before he was permitted to go pro se, counsel objecting to, requesting that the shackles be removed, and then the conversation that you've just recited at 457 to 458 occurred. But we don't have any balancing. We don't see that balancing. Is that problematic under sides?
Again, I think that the court's findings here are implicit. I think that we have a very experienced judge who's been dealing with numerous incidents in this case. It's not just one. And I think it's implicit that the court is finding that the marshal's recommendation should be accepted. Again, should this court wish a more robust statement, I think it could readily obtain it. But I think it's implicit, and that in any event, the error is harmless.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
I think probably the best place for me to start is that these are very complicated defendants when we deal with these issues. As far back as United States versus Welty, this court recognized we understand and sympathize with the frustration and exasperation of the district court. Even a well-founded suspicion of disingenuous or manipulative acts are not substitutes for the proper inquiries. I think that's because we cannot get into anyone's mind, especially Mr. Washington's mind and what was happening there. I think the record screams of his frustration and exasperation, whether well-founded or not, that he thought he was being railroaded in some way. And that I would suggest to the court that is certainly not a basis to find that the inquiry in this case was sufficient. Your Honor, I think you sort of invited me to share this, and I looked back at McFadden, and in that case, I will add that the standby counsel did open and close and examine the defendant in that case, and again, it has been held to its facts ever since that time. I don't think Judge Bartle's inclination here was not to find a waiver, and then it was to find a waiver because this was such a complicated situation. It was actually the government at the end of the colloquy here that said, Your Honor, we don't think you can find this waiver. And he said, I don't know what to do. We cannot draw and quarter them. He didn't know what to do. He was not confident about the colloquy. So I think that's very telling from the record and also the government's position in Taylor, that where a defendant, and this is a quote, creates a verbal impasse with the judge or defendant's behavior prevents a fulsome colloquy, whether it's the Peppers colloquy or just as Mr. Zausmer talked about the basic requirements that the Supreme Court has put in place, when the defendant will not engage, we simply cannot find a knowing and intelligent waiver there.
So let's play this out. We're in the courtroom. We have the defendant being asked questions by the court. The defendant chooses to engage in a similar type of, I don't really want to talk about the federal rules of evidence, I want to talk about the discovery that my counsel before delivery showed me. And he just goes off and off and off. But then says, I want to be pro se. And you have counsel is still sitting there. And counsel's like pulling at him. If you really want to go pro se, you better answer these questions. I'm not listening to you. Mm-hmm. You can't be trusted. You just committed perjury to the court. What is a district court judge supposed to do then? Because that's the scenario you're asking us to draw out, is he's got to answer the questions. He's not responding to the court. He's got an apparently poor relationship with counsel. What do you do?
Well, I'm not suggesting any required type of answer. I think if the court says, you understand that I cannot find that you are knowingly and intelligently waiving your right to counsel if you do not engage in this colloquy and show me that you understand what's happening, I think that is fair warning that a defendant has to just engage, show that they understand what is happening. Mr. Washington, one cannot tell from this record where his mind was or what he was thinking about. We just can't find that waiver here.
Is there any question about his competence in the record?
There was, Your Honor, the government asked that he be evaluated prior to sentencing.
Right.
And while he does have mental health issues, he was found competent to continue.
Okay.
But he was he was uncooperative in that effort, in that evaluation.
He was uncooperative in that effort. That's correct.
And in at page 471, the judge says you're not familiar with the rules of procedure and you're not familiar with the rules of evidence response. Well, I never answered to the question. I mean, he knows what's happening and he's not responding. Are you asking us to sell Judge Bartles? You can't. You got to keep at it.
Not that he has to keep at it, but that if he then says, I'm going to end this if you do not participate and you will proceed with counsel, because counsel is the default presumptive position. We are looking to whether there is a waiver, and we simply can't find. And that's not, I mean, there seems to be some confusion about the clear and unambiguous request, which there absolutely was here, no question, and whether he can get through and show a knowing and intelligent waiver. I'll very briefly, if I may, with regard to the prejudice, with the shackling, I didn't address it as much as obviously I would have liked to, but I just want to say, I mean, as far back as, I mean, there are citations to the 1800s in DEC about the intangible difficulties that people experience mentally. I, as an attorney, could never be so effective if I had shackles on my legs. And when I think the government is downplaying that, but there is no question about the role they play in the confusion, the exasperation that took place here.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We will take this case under advisement and thank counsel for their excellent written and oral submissions. Thank you so much. Be well.